First, this is the conference manager committee, secondly, straight to the point. A couple of years ago, I proved the following theorem, which just appeared. This is when I actually proved it, and this is when it was printed. No? So, let G be SL2 over Z mod BZ. Let A be a set of generators. Now, in additive combinatorics, so first of all, why is it now called arithmetic combinatorics? Because people have started to multiply. People are starting to study the non-abelian case, such as this one. Now, in the abelian case, or more generally in the nilpotent case, we have usually a dichotomy. A set can grow or not grow, and we would like to know when and why each case occurs. But I believe that in simple groups, in general, you're going to have only one case. Things have to grow a lot. So you don't have a dichotomy, at least not a qualitative one. So, A, and this is the important part, or the harder part, if A is not already the entire thing, and by the way, when I write these things that look like absolute values, I just mean the number of elements of the set. And when I write, say, A times A, I just mean the set of all products of two elements of A. And A times A times A is the set of all three products, of all products of three things. So, if A is not already the entire thing, then A times A times A will be much larger than A. Well, the implied constant, I don't even have an implied constant in this way of stating things, where epsilon depends only on delta. So it is absolutely crucial that things do not depend on P, otherwise the statement would be meaningless. All right, what happens if the set is very large? That is, if it's almost as large as G? Well, what I proved was the following. There is a delta such that if A is larger than G to the 1 minus delta, then if you just consider all products of A and its inverses, and their inverses, all products of length up to K, this is going to be the entire group. Now, by A sub K, this notation I will use time and again, I mean simply the set of all products of elements of A and their inverses of length up to K. That is the set of all values of words of length up to K. I'm just saying the same thing twice. Now, the second part, it was the easier part for me, and by now there are better statements, better, stronger statements. So, Gauss show essentially that K equals 3 and delta 0 equals 1/6 is fine, and in fact, you don't even need inverses. And since then, or rather, Gauss proved something that looked, a statement that looked a bit different, but Nicolov and Piper noticed that it implied this. With these two values, as opposed to some values, and Baba, Nikolov, and Piper have got this for all groups that don't have small dimensional complex representations. So, for example, SL2 has no complex representations of dimension less than about p, well, p minus 1 over 2, in fact. So, they have got this for many groups. In particular, all groups of Lie type, that's certainly SLN. And their proof is much more elegant than mine for part B. So let me focus on part A. But before, let me tell you that this is not what I will be talking about. Now, let me just tell you, before I go into what I will actually be talking about, let me tell you a couple of things that follow from that. Why do people care? So, for example, you get right away that when you have D equal to SL2 Zn mod PZ and A a set of generators, well, G is basically a simple group, or rather, PSL2 is a simple group. Now, there's this very general conjecture by Babai for which no cases were known, and it follows immediately from this that Babai's conjecture is true for SL2. What does it mean? What does Babai's conjecture say? And every element of G can be expressed as a product of length, at most a power of a logarithm, log G or log P, whichever, on the elements, a product of elements of A and A inverse. So this is Babai's conjecture. In other words, every set of generators of SL2 generates it quickly. Now, there are many other consequences, mostly derived by people other than myself. Fortunately, Alex gave a talk 2 days ago, and I hope you came to it. So, just ask them if they didn't come to the talk. But basically, you know, when you have some fixed set of generators coming from SL to Z, then the thing is free at first, so you get pretty easily that the diameter is log, not log to a power, but you can actually get something stronger, as Burgan and Gambert showed. You can get that these become expander graphs. You see, in part, an idea of Sarnak. But so, and now they have developed all of these things for affine C. But as I said, I will not be talking about this today. I will be talking about something else. Let me make a few minor changes to the statement. All right. Now it's true. Well, it was true, but now it's new. Very good. How does the proof go? So the tools are all from arithmetic combinatorics, basically. But now the language of groups of Lie type is present throughout. Essentially, no algebraic geometry is harmed in the course of the proof, in the sense that there is one argument, basically one idea from algebraic geometry used over and over, namely that if you show that something is true on a Tarisky open dense, it's enough to just show that that Tarisky open dense has at least one point, it's not empty, and then it's pretty big, it's generically true. And then, well, I will show you what you can do with things that are generically true. But first of all, what is the reason for this peculiar statement? Why 3 copies of A? Why not 2, and why not 200? Well, so, of course, we all know where some of arithmetic combinatorics started. So if we were to show that, if we show the statement with 10 copies or 100 copies of A, then we have proven it for 3 copies. Well, even if we put a few inverses in here. And in fact, that's what we will do. We will prove that things grow. If you allow yourself to multiply things 100 times, say, then this is true. It's roughly, say, 100. So this is really basically Ruja. It's non-commutative Ruja. So what else? So let me say that what really lies behind this all is either the sum product theorem or something related to the sum product theorem. But there are two more technical things in between that I would like to mention. So technical here is not meant as an insult. Otherwise, it'd be the wrong place. So the Balogh-Semeradi-Gauss is used. Now, I'm not sure of whether Balogh-Semeradi-Gauss will survive in the proof if I manage to do SLN. In SL2, I use Balogh-Semeradi-Gauss, which I won't state, but then Burgano showed how to remove Balogh-Semeradi from the proof. Now I use it again. I will tell you where. In general, I might have to replace Balogh-Semeradi by these very useful estimates in section 2.7 of Tao and Wu's book, which work for sets of very different sizes. They give you somewhat weaker results. So, but let me also tell you something that really does not belong to arithmetic combinatorics, but really belongs to the study of growths in infinite groups. So here, we study growths. This is arithmetic or additive combinatorics. But there are people also who have been studying groups asymptotically in infinite groups. You know, Gromov and everybody else. And there's this very nice paper by Eskin Moses O, and there they formalized an idea, which, I mean, it was present in a very primitive way in what I did in SL2, but it's, Eskin Moses O really got the right idea, the right formulation, and this is what we will be using. So it's escape from some varieties. What does this mean? This basically means that if that generically true in an algebraic geometrical sense is good enough for us. So, to be precise, if you can, so say that you want to avoid a certain special case. When you're not in the special case, you say you're in a generic situation. Now, any case of codimension, of positive codimension. So, escape says that at least A times a constant element of A sub K, no, A times itself and its inverse a few times, are generic. Well, K and the implied constant just depend on what you mean by generic. So, for example, at some point in the argument, you might think, that would be really nice and easy if you could assume that all the eigenvalues in your matrix are distinct. And this tells you, well, you can assume that. Now, about sum product, the sum product theorem. By now, I really think that the sum product theorem is a shadow of a more general result. But, and that the more general result will be used towards the end of this talk for large sets. But let me state what the traditional formulation of the sum product theorem is. So, we'll be like a computer scientist and just write initials. It says that if A is a subset of Z mod BZ, we say not too large, then either A grows under addition or A grows under multiplication. Now, in SL2, I actually reduce things after a lot of work, well, some work, to this. No? So I managed to show that if in SL2, if that is not true, then you can get a contradiction to this statement, a statement in the ground field. And much of the proof was about constructing a set like that, a set that would violate this. So today we will also construct something, or start to construct something, that violates a theorem about the field, not about groups. But though it's equivalent to this, it's better not to think about it in these terms. So the sum product theorem, as was shown by Burgan, Katz, and Tao, is equivalent, and well, part of the connection has been done by Elekes before, it's equivalent to an incidence theorem, which I will not quite be using either, but it's much closer to the thing to the form in which I will be using these ideas. So it's basically Semeradi-Trotter over Z mod BZ. What does that mean? You have a set of points and lines in the plane, but not the plane over the reals, rather the plane over the plane over Z mod PZ. And this will work for many rings. In fact, it will be closer to the truth to say that I'm considering the plane over the ring Z mod PZ cross Z mod PZ. But then you have to take care of exceptions. So let me not state it this way right now. So let's say that there are about as many points as lines, so you don't really need that in this strong form. That's about n, where n is smaller than p to the 1 minus delta. Then the incidence theorem tells you that there cannot be too many incidences, too many point-line pairs where the point lies on the line. Now, what is the trivial bound on this? The trivial bound is n squared, but what some people in the know like to call the trivial bound is n to the 3/2. Because you can get that through a very nice argument using just Cauchy's inequality in a page. So the incidence theorem tells you that you can improve on that bound. So 3/2 minus epsilon. Now, what I will actually be using, something that I can prove using the sum product theorem, is not quite this. What I will be using is the moral of the incidence theorem. What is the moral of the incidence theorem? It's that you cannot have too many different linear relations among too few things. Many large subsets, xn, x small. But essentially, what we will do is construct a forbidden configuration. Now, some things leaving tuples where the entry is leaving something constrained, and where you have very many linear relations, each of which is satisfied by as many tuples as could possibly satisfy a linear relation. So, let us get started. You will notice that these are statements over Z mod PZ, whereas what we want is to prove something over a group. So how do we go down to Z mod PZ? So the first half, I've already proved it for SLN by now, and I think it can be proven in the same way for all semi-simple Lie groups. For the reductive Lie groups, you would modify the statement slightly. So from G to K. So, let K be a field. G, SLN, whatnot. So, A, a set of generators. So first of all, let me not prove any of these lemmas, but let me tell you why they are sensible. And the reason why they are sensible will give you the idea of the proof. So for any maximal torus, what's a maximal torus? Well, the group of diagonal matrices is a maximal torus. So a maximal torus is just a group of diagonal matrices, and there is some way of writing the thing. We have that the intersection of A with a maximal torus is not too large. No, and it's understood that all the constants will depend, all implied constants depend only on N, not on the ground field. So A sub k to the 1 over n plus 1. And what is the meaning of 1 over n plus 1? 1 over n plus 1 is just the dimension of the torus divided by the dimension of G. Very well. So why is this sensible? First of all, this is the right dimension. Yeah? You have something, you have the intersection of A with the maximal torus, and I'm saying that that compares to the size of A, or rather A sub K, which is, if A doesn't grow, will be pretty much the same thing as A. It will compare to the size of A sub K as the dimensions compare. This is the dimension of T over the dimension of G. Now, how would you prove such a statement? Well, you have this torus whose dimension is 1 over n plus 1 times the dimension of the entire group as a variety. So you can, in fact, stick it into n plus 1 different directions. In fact, if you stick it in n plus 1 generic directions, they will be pretty much independent. Now, if I'm allowed to walk 10 miles in each of three independent directions, I will cover a volume of at least a constant times 1,000 cubic miles. So if I'm told that I'm not going to cover a volume greater than that, then I know I cannot walk more than 10 miles. Lemma 2. So I will denote by K of G the tuple of coefficients of the characteristic polynomial of a matrix G. It doesn't matter in which basis I write it, of course. Now, there is something very nice about LaTeX in that it has two kappas. So I will use the other kappa to denote something that is almost exactly the same thing, namely the conjugacy class of G. If you cannot distinguish these two kappas, then it does not matter. Because after all, for generic matrices, meaning for matrices with distinct eigenvalues, the two things are the same. One thing gives you the other. So, lemma 2 says, that there's a fair number . So K and implied constants, all the K's and all implied constants depend only on N. So the characteristic polynomial, the set of characteristic polynomials of A sub K is at least A to the dimension of T over the dimension of G. Now, why is this sensible? Because I have A sub K, I'm able to multiply A, by a few things. So basically I'm able to change the direction of A. Think of A as some sort of object in space, and I'm changing its direction. And so the dimension of G, or the dimension of T, is, say, 3. No? So we are in three-dimensional space. So it's really 4 for SL3. So what I'm saying here is that if I have an object of volume V, then it has at least one shadow of length, at least V to the 1/3 space, or V to the 1 over the number of dimensions. And I'm able to stick things in generic directions by escape. So we're working over finite fields, so all of these directions, it's not that geometrical, it's more combinatorial. So it's, you know, you get some one-to-one maps, or maps that are almost injective generically, and so on. Side note, if that was a total excursus that distracted you, ignore that. So, lemma 3. And lemma 3 is actually one of the easiest to prove, and it's true for all groups, basically. Yes. So let me just say here that let G be a group. And you don't even need things to generate G. But, so, by CG, I mean the elements commuting with G. So a centralizer of G. So then there is a G in A such that it commutes with very many things in A, or rather with very many things in A times A inverse. So the intersection of the centralizer of G with A inverse A is going to be at least A divided by A inverse times the number of different conjugacy classes intersecting A. So what is the idea here? The idea here is the following. Just take one element in each conjugacy class and conjugate it by many different things. So all of these conjugates, any two conjugates in different conjugacy classes are going to be distinct by definition. What happens with conjugates in the same conjugacy class? Can two conjugates of the same element be the same? Yes, but only if, so H1 G H1 inverse equals H2 G H2 inverse if and only if H2 inverse H1 commutes with G. So just by commutation, and this is just by conjugation, and this is where that comes from, you are able to have lots of growth unless you have lots of commutativity with some element, and in fact with many elements. You just need one. So what can we do now? Well, now let us go back to the SLN setting. This is a very general lemma. And in the SLN setting, as I said, we can assume that all the eigenvalues of my matrix are distinct. And what happens when you have such a so-called regular semisimple element? What does the centralizer of a matrix with distinct eigenvalues look like? Think of it as a diagonal matrix. You have a diagonal matrix with distinct eigenvalues. Which elements commute with that? Only diagonal matrices commute with that, and all diagonal matrices do. In other words, well, in very general terms, people can say that if you have a so-called regular semisimple element, which is a generic element, then it's commutate. The things that commute with it form a maximal torus. There is maximal torus T such that, so G, here G is again SLN, A is a set of generators. There is a maximal torus such that the intersection of TK with A sub K is large, at least compared to the number of conjugacy classes. But what does this mean? What happens if you put lemma 1, lemma 2, and the corollary to lemma 3 together? So, this tells us that there are many conjugacy classes. Can there be too many conjugacy classes? Can the number of conjugacy classes be much larger than this? What would happen if the number of conjugacy classes were greater than this by something in the exponent? Say 1 over n plus 1 plus 0.1. What would happen? So here he was assuming nothing about A other than the fact that it generated. Now, let me assume. So G is SLN. A is a set of generators. So assume that A does not grow. Okay? So that also A sub K will be of size at most A to the 1 plus O of epsilon. So what can you conclude? What happens when you put? So can you reverse this inequality? Can you tell me that, can you give me an upper bound for kappa of A sub k? Well, suppose that kappa of A, or kappa of A sub k, I would just put k squared or something here, suppose it were very large. Now, because of this assumption, this is close to 1. So if there were very many conjugacy classes, many more than A to the 1 over n plus 1, then there would be a torus with many more than A to the 1 over n plus 1 elements. But that would enter in, that would be in contradiction to lemma 1. So by and 4, say, lemma 4, which is a corollary. For lemmas 1 and 4, you have that the number of conjugacy classes of A is no larger than A to the 1 over n plus 1 plus O of epsilon. So lemmas 1 and 4 allow you to reverse inequality in lemma 2. And what can you say about the number of elements in a torus? Here I said there were many in relative terms. What can you say in absolute terms relative to this? Well, we have an upper bound, a lower bound for k of A sub k, namely lemma 2. No? So we just plug this in and obtain for some torus, in fact for many tori, the intersection here is at least A to the 1 n plus 1 minus O of epsilon. So before we proved that there were not too many elements in a torus and that there were many conjugacy classes, now I've shown that you can reverse inequalities. So we know more or less exactly, well, we know more or less how many conjugacy classes and elements in a torus there are. It's about the same in each case. Now, in fact, think of them as points and lines, almost. So what we will do is construct a forbidden configuration where the lines are going to be coming from elements in a torus and the points are going to be coming from conjugacy classes or characteristic polynomials, if you wish. But how are we going to construct incidences between the points and lines that will be coming from these two things? So, constructing a forbidden configuration. Well, too many relations among which things? So consider, so let T0, T1 up to T3 be elements of the diagonal. Oh. It will actually be coming from the intersection of the diagonal with A sub k. Then I claim that this map for each j, this map is a linear form. It's a linear form on G. It's a linear form in how many variables? By the way, does the S come in the way or not? Yes? So what does this linear form look like? Think of the elements of T, think of the TIs as being diagonal matrices. So what do these linear forms look like? They are basically T11, G11, plus T22, G22, plus T33, G33, for each T. So you have a linear form in three variables. So these are... And what can you say about four linear forms in three variables? When I ask a question, I actually want an answer. What can you say about four linear forms in three variables? No, these are not equations, forms. So four linear forms in three variables, they are linearly dependent. I mean, not just generically, but always. Thanks for your courage. At any rate, I also mean that. Yes. At any rate, follow his example. So you have that these four linear forms are dependent. Well, no, in fact, you could write down exactly how they are dependent. So, well, I will just write things very generally, but you could write down exactly how they are dependent. So, C1, C0, trace GC. So there are coefficients, C0 up to C3, such that this is always true. In practice, we choose T to range in so we let T vary, and we let Tj be T to the j. So T0 is 1, T1 is T, T2 is T squared, and so on. So you get these very nice linear relations, and you also get C0 prime raised T0 G inverse, because you see the maps G goes to trace of inverse of TJG, those are also linear forms on the diagonal entries of G inverse. It comes from the fact that this is the trace of the inverse is just a character of dimension 3, just as well. Second gradient. But then we've got the linear relations I promised among the objects I promised. Sorry? Pretty much, yes, because once you have... Sorry?
Which is the consequence of the trigger.
Yes, exactly, yes.
And then the C vary over many possibilities.
Yes, so the G's and the T's will vary over many possibilities. As every T gives you a linear relation, and every G gives you a point satisfying that linear relation. A point in a box of traces. It's a set of too many linear relations in Z mod BZ. So these are elements. These vectors are just elements of Z mod BZ, cross Z mod BZ. And you get, because I chose in that way, you're basically going to get a different tuple of C0s and C1s and so on for every value of T. So we're going to have many tuples, many linear relations. So you have many linear relations among many things, because for every G you're going to get a tuple, you know, the second tuple in each case, and at the same time all of these tuples live in a constrained space, because these live so many CIs. Why? Because there are many diagonal elements. And there are also many G's, each G gives a relation, but each entry of G is constrained. This is an element. This is basically the characteristic polynomial of T0G. So it's living in this small box of characteristic polynomial. a box, it's a box with small sides. So you have a contradiction to the moral of the incidence theorem. And you can state the moral precisely and prove it. So. Well, of course you get all. Yes, in, for each t, yeah, not of course, but yeah, you do. You need to choose. To be completely honest, you need to choose an auxiliary element H, and then you have that all of these traces, and the trace of H G and the trace of inverse H G determines G pretty much. So that's how you get so many things. Yes. Don't worry, it works. Yeah. I mean, I sent you the file. Okay. All right. So only one caveat. So whether or not you choose to see what I'm about to say as technical, and hence a function of our living right now as opposed to 5 years in the future, well, that's your choice. I don't know. But so this works nicely except for sets of the size. So we are done. But for sets of a very particular size, we get sort of stuck because we're working over Z mod PZ cross Z mod PZ. It's a plane over that. So there are some counterexamples to the incidence theorem coming from the fact that there are counterexamples to the sum product theorem over Z mod PZ cross Z mod PZ. Namely, take A to be the subfield Z mod PZ. It doesn't grow under either addition or multiplication. So what do you do for subsets of that size? Subsets that give you a set of tuples, trace of G inverse of size about P. Well, it's actually the ugliest portion of the paper right now, but the underlying idea is good. Because, well, basically then you pass to a maximal parabolic. And then if in this maximal parabolic, the corner that looks like SL2 does generate SL2, then you just use SL2. If not, you're basically in a Borel. But what happens in a Borel? So, as I promised, I will show you what the sum product theorem is a shadow of. So both growth in Borels and the sum product theorem are shadows of the following. Let G be a group, any group. Let epsilon be an abelian group of automorphisms. It's an abelian group acting on G. And assume that you have, well, so you're given AG by epsilon such that basically these maps don't have non-trivial fixed points. This is a slightly technical condition, but for y inverse y, either y is the identity or y has not non-trivial fixed points. Then you have growth. Y makes A grow. So I will state a statement. I will not write down the strongest statement I can show, but I will write down one that is strong enough for growth in Borels. It is easy to state. Then Y2 A6 is at least as large as half of A times Y, pretty darn large, comma, the entire thing that you could possibly generate from Y and A. So as I said, you can be more precise, because you can make the statement precise enough that for the special case of fields, you get the strongest sum product theorem known, or pre-sum product theorem, namely that the one that's present in Konyagin-Libichuk and in Burgan's paper. Oh yes, that's just like A sub K. So this is Y inverse identity squared applied to A's. It's just a very bounded set of products. So, you know, you have things like this. Yes, 6 refers to multiplication in G, these 2 refers to multiplication in epsilon. So, but I can make 2 and 6 smaller by doing casework. What I mean is that, yes, okay. Technical note. So, what are 2 special cases? So, this is the statement. Examples. You can have G equal to set mod B set, epsilon equal to the multiplicative group, and an option by multiplication. Then the assumption is certainly true, because fields have no zero divisors. No? So if the multiplication map in Z mod B set, the multiplication by an element other than 1, has no fixed points other than 0. And this gives you the so-called Prism product theorem. So from the stronger statement, that slightly stronger statement, you get exactly this. Oh, which is U2 Konyagin-Libichuk. There's really a 1 hidden here. So this is large, and from that you can deduce the sum product theorem in a few steps, basically by using the Ruge distance or the Ruge-Blonek estimate, and then using the Katz-Tau lemma, as has been shown by other people. So this is the first example. The second example will be something that is useful here, namely, let G be the set of unipotent matrices in SLN. There's just one case. It's actually using 2 different guises for large sets. A set of unipotent matrices, and epsilon is the diagonal matrices, and they are acting by conjugation. Now there you have to be more careful with this condition, because it's not immediately true that for every element, for every diagonal element, you're going to have no fixed points by conjugation, because you have R to the minus 2, and here you could have 1x0101. You could have a weight space, and you could have an element of a non-maximal torus. But you can actually get this is not required of all elements of epsilon, just of the elements of y inverse y, and you can winnow out y by a neighborhoods argument, a very simple one. So the condition actually holds. And then you actually get this, that if you just let if you have enough diagonals and they are acting on enough unipotents, the diagonals make things grow, unless they have no room to grow. And then you're basically done. You just stick the unipotents in the group in all sorts of different directions and you're done. So that's it, really. And, well, I'm starting to work, well, I'm working on SLN. I have been working on SLN for a year. And what I thought was the worst difficulty seems to be over now, but now there are all of these difficulties that I didn't thought were so bad. So for a good while, you will hear only of SL3, I think. So, and then there are many other things. If I manage to do SLN, I will manage to do SP2N, I'm pretty confident. But for SON, I will need more ideas. And I can tell you the reasons why later. But that's enough for now, I think.